From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Can a defeated ISIS keep its brand alive? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. The Syrian city of Raqqa is now in ruins, no longer the capital of the Islamic State that drew thousands of militants to the Middle East. But students of ISIS say almost 40 so-called provinces still exist in other parts of the world, including Southeast Asia and Africa. That may explain the ambush deaths of four American soldiers in Niger, where the Trump administration wants to weaponize drones to kill ISIS recruiters. In the meantime, almost 6,000 fighters have returned to their home countries. Will they help a deadly ideology to survive? Later on today's Talking Point, will old documents raise new questions about the Kennedy assassination? First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. ISIS may have been defeated in Iraq and Syria, but the ideology that motivated the Islamic State is not dead yet. We heard about ISIS provinces around the world and about fighters who've returned to their home countries. Today's Talking Point, more than 53 years since President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, the National Archives is releasing documents as required by federal law. President Trump has tweeted about his interest. We'll talk to a presidential historian about conspiracy theories and other assassination plots. First, this news update. The House passed a budget today, already approved by the Senate. If the president signs off, it'll pave the way to consideration of massive tax cuts. But Speaker Paul Ryan declined to provide any details about that.
This was an enormous step in the direction toward getting comprehensive tax reform and tax cuts for middle-class families over the line, into law, done. This budget that we just passed, that is really important for getting tax reform done. The Ways and Means Committee will be putting out the specific plan very shortly, and they're going to work with all of our members to look at and consider and address their concerns.
Plenty of concerns. Today's budget tally suggests the tax plan may not have easy sailing with a margin of just four votes, 216 to 212. David Hawkins is senior editor at CQ Roll Call. Always good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much, Warren.
How come it was so close?
Well, it was so close because those 212 no votes were every single one of the Democrats joined by 20 Republicans. Those 20 Republicans were split sort of into two camps. There were sort of the Freedom Caucus hardline conservatives who tend to vote against, to be honest, almost anything, because they find something to criticize in almost anything. Some of them thought that there was not enough cuts to social programs, Medicare, promised by this budget. But the really interesting thing was that 11 of them were from New York and New Jersey, two places with very high state and local taxes, who are very fearful that this emerging tax bill is going to trade off lower income tax rates by taking away the deductibility of state and local taxes. You're going to hear in the coming days a lot of people in Congress talking about SALT. Everything things seem to have an acronym these days. SALT stands for state and local taxes. The high tax members of Congress in these high tax states are threatening to kill this entire tax bill if their constituents can't deduct their state and local taxes from their federal taxes.
You mentioned New York and New Jersey. What about California? Weren't there some no votes there, too?
There were a few Republican no votes there from there as well. Yes, there were.
Okay.
So, yes, those are the three big high tax states where if all the Republicans from those three states spurn this tax bill, it's a dead letter.
Okay. Well, one of the questions that came up today with regard to when Speaker Ryan was talking to reporters had to do with the president and whether, in fact, if the budget measure gets to his desk, he'll sign it. Here's a response.
Are you at all concerned that this rollout next week, when you actually detail these tough choices, that he's not going to maybe like some of them and tweet something about it?
He's going to be in Asia, number one. No, I'm just kidding. That was kind of a joke.
That's the tax bill that's being talked about. So David Hawkins, the president, will be in Asia, but we do have international communications electronically.
We do. The president's Twitter habit knows no time or space continuum. You know, Mr. Ryan was trying to make light of something that he is clearly worried about, that the president does. I mean, you remember, this is the same president who, after the House struggled mightily, and it took them several tries to get their version of the Obamacare repeal and replace bill through this spring, they thought with the president's blessing, he then said it sounded too mean to him. So, and the president has already weighed in on the state and local taxes issue a little bit inconsistently. He's already weighed in on whether one of the things that should be given away in return for low tax rates should be limitations on how much we can contribute to our 401ks. So yes, the president does have a habit of course, he's the least traditional president in my lifetime. His non-traditional way of negotiating with Congress is to fire a tweet across their bow at all hours of the day and night.
Okay, and of course, he's had some experience in New York and New Jersey and probably pays some taxes in both states.
Yeah, it certainly does.
So we may then hear from him, even though he is in Beijing with the new leader of China at the time that the rollout actually occurs. That's pretty fast, isn't it? Here's the speaker not giving any details, but they plan the rollout as soon as next week.
Well, they do. It's interesting. He sort of backed away. We have been told 24 hours ago there was a firm date for this that was next Wednesday. Of course, this has been they have had hearings on this. This is unlike the health care bill, which was criticized for not following regular order, the regular legislative process. The Republicans have had plenty of hearings on tax on the tax plans, going back to as far as when Paul Ryan was the chairman of the Tax Writing Ways and Means Committee, not even yet the speaker. So they've had plenty of time to get ready for this. But this state and local taxes hiccup, I think, is making them worried that that what they unveil is a potential non-starter, and they definitely don't want. I mean, this is the president's last big chance at a first-year policy victory. So they are really eager to do something that A, can pass, and that B, he will embrace. And apparently, okay, they don't think they're quite there yet.
David Hawkins, senior editor at CQ Roll Call. As always, many thanks.
Thanks, Warren.
In a moment, can a defeated ISIS keep its brand alive? On To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. In less than 3 years, the Islamic State extended its so-called caliphate in Syria and Iraq to cover some 8 million people. Now, Kurdish and Arab militias, advised by U.S. Special Forces, are wrapping up the remains of Raqqa in Syria. ISIS called that its capital city. But the threat of ISIS is not over. Here's President Trump with reporters yesterday.
We are decimating ISIS in the Middle East. What's happening is they'll go to parts of Africa, they'll go to other places. When they get there, we meet them. It's a dangerous business, I have to say.
Did
it's a dangerous business.
Mission?
So what? No, I didn't. Not specifically. My generals and my military, they have decision-making ability.
According to NBC, the Pentagon wants to militarize drones to pursue ISIS recruiters in Africa. That's where 4 American Special Forces soldiers were killed in an ambush 3 weeks ago. Here's NBC reporter Ken Delanian. Good to have you with us.
Great to be back with you, Warren.
So what about the connection here between what happened in Africa and the concern about ISIS and militarizing the drones?
Well, here's what our sources are telling us. There's been a long-standing desire by the Pentagon, by military officials, by U.S. Africa Command, or AFRICOM, to arm the drones that are flying over this part of Africa. But the Obama administration did not approve that to happen. There was some resistance from some diplomats, and President Obama himself was not interested in doing it. But now this attack and this ambush in which four U.S. soldiers were killed has renewed the urgency on the military side to push that through. And our sources are telling us President Trump is very likely to approve that. And that would represent a significant escalation in sort of the targeted killing aspect of the U.S. drone war. You know, it's going to be controversial.
You said Mr. Obama did not approve of that. We just heard Mr. Trump say, oh, my military people can make those kinds of decisions. But you indicated he still has to approve it.
Well, yes. He very clearly said he didn't approve this particular mission, and that seems to be the case. But a sort of a change in the authorities over whether we take lethal action in a country would need presidential approval. It would probably also need cooperation of the government of Niger.
So, Ken Delaney, and again, a national security reporter for NBC News, how soon might that happen? And does it appear that the four Americans who were killed were pursuing an ISIS recruiter?
In terms of when lethal strikes might happen, it seems to be some way off, perhaps a year or more. Is what we're being told, if at all, of course. You know, there may be a debate over it within the Trump administration. There are good reasons on both sides. There are good reasons to do it, good reasons not to do it. In terms of what happened with this attack, we also have some new reporting on that. This Green Beret unit was operating with Nigerian forces, and they were operating in the open. They are part of a long-standing mission that goes back 10 years where Green Berets are in Niger and other parts of the Sahel, this part of Africa, advising and assisting and helping local governments fight their problem with extremism and al-Qaeda and now ISIS. But what we've learned is there was also a different, more secretive special operations unit operating nearby around the border area between Niger and Mali. And that unit was specifically tasked with going after terrorist organizations, gathering intelligence on terrorist organizations. And what happened was this Green Beret unit had been on a patrol basically through the night, and then they seemed to have been retasked because there was a lead on a particular militant that the other more secretive unit was pursuing. And so they basically asked the Green Berets to go follow this lead, which took them into this village, which apparently was sympathetic to ISIS. And our sources are telling us some of the villagers may have tipped off some militants. And so on the way out of the village, this unit of 12 Americans and 30 Nigerian forces was ambushed by a much larger force. And that's when the four Americans were killed.
That's been a big story, in part because President Trump, of course, got into an argument with the widow of one of those who was killed, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, has sort of tried to explain what was actually going on.
After speaking to Secretary Mattis this morning, I decided to address you because there's been a lot of speculation about the operation in Niger, and there's a perception that the Department of Defense has not been forthcoming. Our soldiers are operating in Niger to build the capacity of local forces to defeat violent extremism in West Africa. Their presence is part of a global strategy. As we've seen many times, groups like ISIS and al-Qaeda pose a threat to the United States, the American people, and our allies.
So let's talk more about this threat that is posed by ISIS, this continuing threat. Robin Wright is senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. She's also a contributing writer for The New Yorker and has recently written a piece called The Ignominious End of the ISIS Caliphate. Robin Wright, always good to have you.
Always great to be with you, Warren.
How ignominious was this?
Well, it's stunning that the ISIS caliphate survived 3 years, 3 months, and 3 weeks, and its decline was quite extraordinary. The U.S.-backed forces in both Iraq and Syria retook the major sites. The largest city was in Iraq, Mosul, and in Syria's capital at Raqqa. And today, the Central Command of the United States has announced that 95% of the ISIS territory has been retaken by its allies.
So 95% has been retaken, and yet we hear about these provinces. So tell us more about those, whether Niger might in fact be one of those.
Well, ISIS has 37 provinces, or vilayats as they call them, and some are dormant, some are small, but all are deadly. The most active ones last year were in Libya, in the Sinai Peninsula, in Egypt, and in Afghanistan. And there were more than 100 attacks in each one of those countries, killing hundreds of people. So this is where the ISIS future is going to be, both in the kind of terrorist attacks it conducts or tries to attack in the outside world, and in among its provinces. It's trying to say it's still a brand. It may not have a caliphate, but it's still very active. And, of course, the question is, have they lost the credibility or the momentum? Now, when you look at places like Niger, you know that there are significant pockets where extremists, whether it's ISIS or al-Qaeda or other extremist movements, are still alive and still a threat to stable governments, to some of our allies. So the ISIS threat is by no means over, but it is taking a very different form.
So, Kendall Linnean, back to you with NBC News. The term ISIS recruiter has been used, I believe you used it in your story, with regard to the units, two units that were involved in Niger. And, of course, Sergeant LaDavid Johnson was the one who became so famous because the president took issue with his widow. Does it appear that ISIS then has a province there? And is that one of the things that an armed drone, armament of drones would be designed to defeat?
Well, I don't know about a province, Warren, but the military has said that the group of militants that attacked the Green Beret contingent outside that village was an ISIS affiliate. But we're also told that al-Qaeda actually retains a lot of sway in the Sahel and in Niger in particular. And some of these groups sort of are, you know, they shift their allegiances depending on which brand of jihadism is shining at that moment. And so a lot of these are local grievances and local groups that may have loyalty to both al-Qaeda and ISIS or one or the other. And I'm not even sure the U.S. intelligence community and the U.S. military is entirely clear in some cases on the particular loyalties of these groups.
So, Robin Wright, what about that? You've been involved for a long time in studying the situation there, and I know you were part of a recent extensive report about both ISIS and al-Qaeda. Are they competitive with one another? If, in fact, this is not an ISIS entity in Niger, might it be an al-Qaeda entity? And would it claim credit, then, for killing the four Americans?
Well, there's a basic difference between ISIS and al-Qaeda. They seek the same thing, and that is ultimately a caliphate, whether it's in the Middle East or takes even greater territory around the world. But they have very different tactics. ISIS, as we've seen very visibly and painfully, wants to take territory, and it's willing to kill even its own believers who might resist that idea. The ends justifies the means, and they engage in all forms of violence. The difference with al-Qaeda is it believes, and Osama bin Laden propagated this, that there should be a conversion of people to the idea of a caliphate, that you had to educate Muslims first and then bring them along. And one of the things that the intelligence community is looking at right now is there the possibility that people do gravitate from ISIS to al-Qaeda, particularly in a place like Syria where you have one whole province, Idlib province in the north, that is now dominated by al-Qaeda? Is that a place that people gravitate to? I've interviewed ISIS fighters who were captured, and it's quite interesting to hear them talk about how the caliphate will live and how ISIS may have made some tactical mistakes, but they still believe in the idea. And, of course, the question is, if they were still on the battlefield, would they move elsewhere? But I think Ken's right. There is this movement that there is an idea out there in the kind of political vacuum, whether it's in parts of Africa or parts of the Middle East, and people are looking for someone who will give them not only direction but power and a gun to achieve it.
Let me introduce Ali Soufan. He is CEO of the Soufan Group, and he's a former FBI special agent. We're glad to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Warren.
A couple of years ago, you released a report, comprehensive report, on people who left their countries to join ISIS, and now you have updated it to discuss the fact that many of them have apparently returned to their home countries. What do you make of that?
Well, we have about 40,000, more than 40,000 foreign fighters that came from more than 110 countries and joined the conflict zone in Iraq and Syria. And after ISIS started losing its territory and the caliphate appears to exist no more, you see people trying to go back. And so far, three countries were able to collect data. And their numbers are about 5,600 people from those 33 countries have already returned. For example, Europe has about 1,200 people who returned. The U.S., we have only seven who returned back. This is an important thing. I mean, we've seen that before. If you recall, after the Soviet jihad in Afghanistan, we had about 10,000 foreign fighters who attended the Soviet jihad, participated in it, and only a few dozens built a network and decided to wage global jihad after that, and they were able to change the world, on especially on 9/11. So this is something that we have to pay attention to from now. We have to monitor these trend lines and predict which one of them is going to be fault lines down the road. We divided the foreign fighters and the returnees into a threat matrix of five categories. One is people who went there for a short period of time. They decided it's not their kind of thing, and they decided to return. Number two are people who went there, participated with ISIS in their tactics and their war, and then they realized that this is not for them. Number three, people who fought with ISIS agree with their tactics, agree with their strategy, but they decided to move on and do other things. Four are people who were arrested either in the battlefield or in Turkey or by third entities and were sent back to their countries. And number five, which is the most dangerous ones, are people who are tasked by ISIS to go back either to their home countries if they believe that their countries do not know about them, or to third countries. And this is something that Robin talked about earlier, going to different areas and different zones that already exist in Africa, but also in Southeast Asia. We've seen foreign fighters who were in Syria fighting in the Philippines, for example. So this is a very dangerous situation down the road. It gives us an idea about the nature of the threat that we're going to have, and it's important to keep monitoring this and deal with the issue of returnees in a way that limit security threats in the West and in the region, frankly.
Ken Delanian, back to you with NBC News. Is there any indication that in Niger, the people who are apparently associated with ISIS were, in fact, natives of that country who went to the Middle East and then came home? Or do we know that much about them?
I don't think we know the answer to that question, Warren. But I wanted to sort of end on an upbeat note, which is, as dire as the situation seems, you can argue that, you know, the fall of Raqqa and the progress that the U.S. has been making against ISIS is really a foreign policy victory for a strategy that did not involve an injection of large numbers of U.S. troops. You know, that the United States learned the lessons of Iraq and Afghanistan and has done this with air power and local forces. And, you know, the top general special operations commander said in July that they've killed like 60,000 ISIS fighters on the battlefields of Iraq and Syria and elsewhere. And that doesn't get a lot of attention. It's kind of a gruesome figure, but it shows that and now that ISIS is being ousted from its caliphate, it shows that the U.S. can make progress in this counterterrorism struggle without injecting large numbers of ground troops.
On the other hand, they have killed a lot of civilians and destroyed some cities, have they not? Raqqa being one of them.
Yeah, and in fact, the civilian casualty numbers are significantly up under the Trump administration, and there seems to have been a loosening of standards, although okay. Exactly what happened there is not clear.
All right, Ken Delanian, again with NBC News. Thanks so much for being on our program. We're going to continue our conversation with Robin Wright, Ali Soufan. We'll also talk with Lizzie Dearden, who is in London, and we'll hear more about people who have gone back to their home countries. On our talking point later, will old documents raise new questions about the Kennedy assassination? To the Point with PRI. That's what you're listening to. We'll be right back.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing.
Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To The Point, talking today about the ignominious end of the ISIS caliphate in Iran and in Iraq and Syria, but also the continuation of the momentum, the ideology behind that organization, and also its links to al-Qaeda. It's been mentioned and emphasized today that some of the people who went to the Middle East to fight on behalf of ISIS have returned home. They're categorized in five different ways, as we heard by Ali Soufan, a former FBI special agent. One place where people have returned is Great Britain. Lizzie Dearden is a home affairs and security correspondent at The Independent. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Tell us, if you will, what is known so far about people who are associated with ISIS, who have or were associated with ISIS, have come back to England, and what are they doing?
So we know that of the 850 people who originally went out to join ISIS, around half of those have returned. So we're looking at about 425 men, women, and some children as well. What we don't know is where those people are. The security services say they are monitoring a lot of them, but realistically, it's very difficult to prosecute people when they return for criminal offences under UK law. So what often happens is people might be arrested when they arrive in an airport, but then they cannot be jailed, no crimes can be proven, and the authorities are forced to then set them free.
How do the authorities know that men, women, and children actually have been in the Middle East fighting for ISIS when they get off the plane?
It varies from case to case, but what often happens is that families report people as missing. A lot of the people who went out in 2013 and 14 especially didn't let their families know, especially some of the younger supporters of ISIS. They just simply disappeared. So what would happen initially is that families would go to the police, and then they would later get a text when someone had already crossed into Turkey or Syria saying where they were. So then those names are added to a database that authorities have, and they have alerts throughout Europe and on British borders as well, so that as soon as those people enter under a certain passport, then they get the alert to say they're coming in.
So when you say men, women, and children, and you say specifically children, are you talking about children who are old enough to go on their own to the Middle East to fight for ISIS, or younger children too?
Younger children mainly. What we saw sometimes was entire families going out, men and women, often couples or extended families. We had cases of sisters going out with children as young as babies, or even going out while they were pregnant and then having the children there. We did also have some teenage recruits going out. There were a group of three girls, and some of them were as young as 15, who managed to go out on their own to join ISIS. But realistically, checks at the airport should stop anyone that age traveling alone. So most of the children were with older family members.
Ali Soufan, back to you with the Soufan Group. You have talked to a lot of people who have come back. What have they said, particularly those who've had families, about their return and what they intend to do? You divided them into several categories, but just interested in how that breaks down.
Well, the people who are willing to talk are people who seem to want to put that experience behind them. There are people who, for example, out of the seven who came to the United States, they are in jail. And at least in the case of one of them, they are working together with the authorities to prevent others from falling into the traps of ISIS. So I think the five categories that we put is a threat matrix, with one, the first category being the lowest threat, and number five, the last category being the most dangerous one. The issue is most of the terrorist attack that's conducted around the world, in the West especially, in the United States, are not really conducted by returnees or conducted by people who directly in contact with ISIS, rather than they were conducted by people who were inspired by the organization. And a lot of times, every time that there's a terrorist attack, you hear, that person was known to the authorities, especially in the United Kingdom or in other places around Europe and France and so forth. And that just gives you an idea, Warren, about the stress that law enforcement and intelligence agencies are under. We heard from Leslie talking about 425 returnees that came to the United Kingdom. That is amazing amount of resources just to do surveillance and to monitor these individuals. And then when you have a terrorist who conduct an attack and he's known to the services, it's not like the services allowed this attack to happen as much as they did not have the resources to cover everyone, so they focused on people who returned from Syria rather than people who were inspired on the internet. So the threat contribute, the returnees threat contribute directly and indirectly to the terrorism environment in the specific countries. And that's why it's important to use these five categories to create a culture of intelligence sharing in the international community, to have solution that's internationally driven but locally implemented, because each country has totally different laws, and also pay attention to returnees that are going to third countries, not back to their own countries, either finding safe havens in other places or going to places like Southeast Asia or like Africa. North Africa, and taking the conflict to other wilayats or provinces for ISIS. So this is these issues are extremely important to monitor and deal with today, because it will help us tremendously down the road, rather than get flat-footed and see a threat mutate into a different form of threat because we didn't deal appropriately with this issue.
Still with us, Robin Wright at the U.S. Institute of Peace, the Woodrow Wilson International Center, and The New Yorker. Is it possible that some of these returnees would be, as we just heard, not just a threat, but in fact able to help assist others from being radicalized, or perhaps to de-radicalize people? Is it safe to rely on them to do that?
Well, I think you're talking about a variety of types who are returning, and I think the danger is not just today. I think this is something, again, we like to game in terms of, okay, this is a finite number, and this is the kind of cutoff point, and the threat goes away. The danger is that some of these people can be pulled back into extremism or into recruiting locally for movements down the road if there's some flashpoint that ignites their anger or their passions. And all of this plays out in a much wider political context. I mean, we celebrate the demise of ISIS caliphate, but and the proof that it is not invincible. But we also have to look at the reality that the political environment in Iraq and Syria is such that there's still no political alternatives emerging. 14 years after the U.S. intervention in Iraq, you still don't have a formula for sharing political power. And the danger is that the kind of alienation you saw ignited by that anger, that sense of that their communities, whole communities, are not invested or protected, could again reignite. So what you have to look for in deciding whether people are going to be active, whether they return home or whether they're in the Middle East itself, is, you know, what comes next? What are the political solutions? And particularly in environments, as Ken had pointed out earlier, where whole communities are destroyed. We went in and we may have forced ISIS out of Raqqa, but Raqqa was just leveled as a result. 85% of it's not inhabitable. I was in Mosul in March, and West Mosul particularly is devastated. I mean, getting basics like electricity working, and it's not just rebuilding the four walls of a house, it's also rebuilding institutions, you know, universities and local government, finding people who can make sure that these communities become viable again. So we're dealing with, yes, the issue of returnees and what happens to the caliphate or after the caliphate, but there are so many much broader questions that get us back to the origins of this problem. We're now in the third generation of jihadi extremists. The first one from the 70s and 80s was localized in Afghanistan and Lebanon. The second generation produced the 9/11 generation that took terrorism to London and Madrid and Kenya and Tanzania and New York and Washington. And now we're dealing with a generation that wants to create a state not only to upend local governments, but to challenge the West and the prevalent ideologies of the 21st century. So we're talking about a huge array of questions that have to be dealt with, of which the returnees are a part.
Lizzie Dearden, back to you. Pardon me. In The Independent, you talk about two kinds of terrorists, people who wanted to go to Syria and Iraq to join the caliphate, and others who want to commit terror attacks in their home countries, and I gather to some extent they are ordered to do that or asked to do that by ISIS, or they have been in the past. And yet you also say they overlap. Tell us more about that.
So initially there is a divide between the people who wanted, back when it was possible, to go and build the caliphate, which was ISIS's original state-building project, and those who wanted to commit terror offences at home. And the overall message of ISIS was to come out if people could. So they were urging people to come to their territories in Syria and Iraq and build that caliphate. And the secondary message was, if you can't come, commit a terror attack at home. But as they've been losing territory, the message has been shifting. And now ISIS's overwhelming aim in its propaganda and its overall strategy is to inspire these global attacks. So what we've seen is a shift in the danger, not so much from people who have gone out and may even be returning, but to those people who are at home and either can't go out or who never even wanted to go out and are now completely focused on committing a domestic terror attack.
Let me go back to Ali Soufan. This, what we heard, just heard from Robin Wright about the destruction of Raqqa and Mosul, reminds me of the Vietnam War, when we famously had a military general saying we had to destroy the village in order to save it. How effective is American involvement in this area, or these areas that we're talking about now? To what extent does it resemble that situation in Vietnam?
Well, I think Robin was brilliant in describing the incubating factors that feed into extremism and radicalization. I mean, when whole communities are destroyed, what do you expect from the new generation going to grow up surrounded by destruction? We're destroying things, but we're not providing any alternative. And if we don't provide that alternative, the day tomorrow is not going to be as good as today. And today is already worse than yesterday. So I think one of the things that need to be done is we need to develop a strategy. And so far, unfortunately, it does not seem we have a strategy. A strategy will have a diplomatic component. A strategy will have an economic component. A strategy will have a global response to rebuilding cities and towns that have been totally destroyed. Most of the factors that led to the existence of groups like ISIS or the current version of Al-Qaeda that we see in Yemen or in Syria or in North Africa have a lot to do with the conflict, with the regional conflict and the local conflicts that exist. And as long as we don't have political solutions for these conflicts, we're going to keep killing them and they're going to keep recruiting more. So one of the things that we need to do is empower not only our military and our intelligence and law enforcement, which doing, I believe, a great job, but also empower the diplomatic initiative. And unfortunately, if you look at our State Department, for example, now most of the assistant secretary positions are still in vacuum. There is no one there. We need to get involved to provide a political solution for Syria, to provide a political agreement among the different Iraqi factions, to stop the war in Yemen and so forth. So unfortunately, we have a lot of tactics. We're using a lot of tactics, but we don't have an overall winning strategy. And I believe that's what happened in some of the examples before, especially in Vietnam.
Lizzie Dearden, Great Britain has been in the Middle East a lot longer than the United States has, obviously. Does your country have a strategy of the sort that Ali Soufan describes?
Absolutely not, unfortunately. There's been a growing focus by the government on online radicalization and removing the kind of propaganda that security services know that terrorists who've carried out recent attacks in the UK have viewed. But what seems to have been overlooked is a broader context about why people are drawn to these kind of ideologies in the first place. Because ideally, we shouldn't be in a place where anyone would view ISIS propaganda, go out, pick up a knife and kill people. I know that I have viewed a lot of ISIS propaganda and never once has that crossed my mind. And that's because I don't have the kind of grievances or perceived grievances that a lot of ISIS supporters in the UK have. And research has shown that as a lot of the people who support ISIS, they may be economically deprived, they might not have good employment prospects, good education, and overwhelmingly they're often from backgrounds who were historically immigrants. So they might be second or third generation people, often from the Middle East, who do have a historic tie to those countries who may have experienced colonial upheaval in the past. And the way they view the intervention by the American military and the British military now or in the past is often very, very negative, even before they become radicalized by a group like ISIS.
Okay. We're going to have to leave it at that. And I want to thank you all very much for being on our program and providing us a lot more information than I've heard elsewhere about this ongoing situation. Again, Lizzie Dearden is Home Affairs and Security Correspondent at The Independent. Ali Soufan is CEO of the Soufan Group, former FBI Special Agent. Robin Wright is with the U.S. Institute of Peace, Woodrow Wilson International Center, contributing writer to The New Yorker, familiar voice on our program. Ken Delanian, we heard earlier on the first half of our program, is with NBC News. Thank you all very much, and we'll talk to all of you again, of course, in the future. New documents, new conspiracy theories about the assassination of President Kennedy. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Ana here with today's Talking Point. It's been 53 years and 11 months since President John F. Kennedy was gunned down in Dallas, but not all the relevant documents have been released. Oliver Stone's film JFK, released in 1991, is among the reasons that conspiracy theories have been kept alive. From the trailer for JFK, here's Kevin Costner playing the New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison.
Y'all got to get into your minds how the hell the spooks think. Now, they're not ordinary crooks. Think the unthinkable. Question everything. Now, we're through the looking glass here, people. White is black, and black is white.
Tim Naftali is a presidential historian and professor at New York University. Today, he's at the Kennedy Presidential Library in Boston. It's great to have you back on our program. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Warren.
Think the unthinkable. A lot of people have been doing that for a long time. Why have these documents been withheld for so long? How relevant does it appear they are, and why are they being released now?
Well, one thing that we have to understand is that in the 1990s, because of the welter of conspiracy theories and because of the emotional effect of the JFK movie, Congress decided to pass a law saying anything relevant to understanding the assassination of John F. Kennedy must be released as soon as possible, and all of it must be out within 25 years. The net that they cast to find documents to make this collection was very broad. It included, and this is because of the conspiracy theories, it included policy towards Vietnam. Why? Because there were some Americans who believed that John F. Kennedy was assassinated because he wanted to pull us out of the war there. The net included documents about killing Castro. Why? Because some Americans believed that the Cubans found out about that and killed Kennedy first. These documents, the net was cast widely, and there was a very serious, sober group of nonpartisan Americans who were put together, chosen by President Clinton. This was the Assassination Records Review Board. They looked at these materials, and by the way, this collection ultimately consisted of about 5 million pages. They looked at the material and determined what was necessary to get out by 1998 to give the American people the materials they needed to come to their own conclusion about Lee Harvey Oswald and a conspiracy. But there were other materials in that were caught in that net, and they were tangentially related to these issues of conspiracy and assassination. And the intelligence community said, these have nothing to do with Lee Harvey Oswald or the Cubans or this or that. This would releasing this material would undermine national security. And the review board agreed with them and said, well, according to the act, a president, whoever's president in 2017, is going to have to determine if these should be released too. And those are the documents that we're waiting to receive today. And the irony is that, of course, in 1992, no one predicted that Donald J. Trump would be president in 2017. And it's Donald J. Trump, who happens to be an amateur conspiracy theorist, who is going to determine what of this tangential material should be released to the public.
Is there still, of course, he's indicated that he finds this absolutely fascinating, and as you indicated, he is an amateur conspiracy theorist. I guess anybody who's a conspiracy theorist is an amateur of some kind, but in any case, is there still resistance from the intelligence agencies? Are they worried about what might be revealed about Vietnam or about Cuba?
Well, look, I don't know. They haven't told me, but given their past performance and past positions, and by the way, you can learn some of this by reading the final report of the review board. It's online. There were a number of things caught up in this net, names of sources of agents who were not directly related to the Lee Harvey Oswald case. National Security Agency decrypts, that's decoded material. Things like that, the review board felt were not necessary to release in the 90s. If they're released now, they'll tell us a lot of things about the spy versus spy world of the early 60s. We may know some more. We may learn a few more details about the efforts to kill Lumumba in Congo, efforts to kill Trujillo in the Dominican Republic, things that the Church Committee, which is an investigative committee in the 70s, looked at. But there were some details, like the names of some CIA operatives who were involved, that were not released. Those could be released now. Are these things going to change the grand narrative of Dallas 1963? It is highly unlikely, because if the review board did its job, and no one criticized it for not being serious in the 90s, that stuff would have come out long ago. But are we going to learn new stuff about the CIA, about covert action on the margins? Yes, and it could be very interesting.
It certainly could be very interesting. The president is absolutely right about that, amateur or not. Is there expected to be a focus on Mexico City?
Well, a couple of things about that. This is Warren, you're referring to the issue of one of the conundrums, which is why did Lee Harvey Oswald go to Mexico City just before Dallas? Why was he seeking a visa to return to the Soviet Union? He meets with Soviets and Cubans, because he needs a transit visa to go to the Soviet Union via Cuba. Both diplomats in both embassies don't give him what he wants. Later investigations show that some of the people he talked to in those embassies were intelligence people. What did he tell these intelligence people? Did he relay to them his intention of trying to kill the president? We don't know. And the intelligence community, after the fact, looked into this. Now, there was some evidence that because of U.S. cooperation with the Mexican government, some of his telephone calls to these two embassies, the Cuban and the Soviet, were intercepted. What did he say in these calls? How much did he reveal of himself? Could the U.S. intelligence community have figured out what this man was planning to do? Did we actually know more before Dallas about his intentions? This would be more a story about government incompetence than a conspiracy, but perhaps he told the Cubans something which makes them, and some have argued this, an accomplice. Not that the Cubans wanted him to kill Kennedy, but they didn't do anything when he told them he'd try. These are sort of elements of books that have come out in years past. If there was something terribly, if there were a smoking gun about these issues, I suspect the review board would have put it out in the 90s. But are there tantalizing clues that are in some very obscure intelligence reports that didn't come out in the 90s that may lead people to suspect some of the things I just mentioned? Who knows? We don't know. But that's what people mean about Mexico City. It's Oswald's strange trip there before Dallas.
We've just got a minute or two left, but the CIA has acknowledged, and I believe the FBI did the same thing, keeping documents away from the Warren Commission, which, of course, was the first investigating agency into this, led by the former Chief Justice of the United States. Have they explained why they kept documents away from the Warren Commission?
A lot of that has come out. It's partly because of a knee-jerk reaction to giving more than other people need to know. It's, I think, partly due to the fact that they didn't want to talk about efforts to kill Castro. That was in part to protect Kennedy, John F. Kennedy's memory. It may be in part because Alan Dulles was on the Warren Commission and had no interest in that being shared.
Former head of the CIA.
Former head of the CIA. And they also didn't want to reveal information they had that they had from defectors. They were concerned about undermining the protection of those defectors. They shared a little bit, but not a lot. So the CIA did not share what it could have at that point. That material we learned subsequently.
Very quickly, 10 seconds left. When is the president finally going to decide what to release and what not to?
According to the act, it's supposed to happen today.
All right.
So we'll see.
Okay. Tim Naftali, always fascinating to talk with you, a presidential historian, professor at New York University, steeped in all of this. Thanks, as always, for being on our program.
My pleasure, Warren.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.